I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. When he was a member of the Tax Increment Financing Commission, Phil Glenn opposed an architecture firm's plans to locate its headquarters in the Crossroads. Mayor Sly James removed him from the commission. Today, Phil Glenn is running to become Kansas City mayor. We'll ask whether that dismissal could affect his chances and how his family's run-in with a robber has influenced his approach to getting a handle on violent crime in the city. Then, immigrants are part of the foundation of our country and of this city, but often the many contributions from immigrant women have been overlooked. One historian is telling their stories in the shaping of Kansas City. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Mayor Sly James once appointed Phil Glenn to the city's TIF commission, but it was James' decision also to pull Glenn off that commission in 2015 after Glenn opposed a headquarters for architecture firm BNIM in the Crossroads. We're about to find out the impact of that move on Glenn, who's now a candidate for Kansas City mayor. Glenn and his wife co-own a 50-employee firm that finances and supports housing and economic development projects in American Indian communities. The primary election for mayor is now less than a month away, and Phil Glenn joins me here in the studio. Welcome. Good to have you here.
Good morning. Thanks.
So in 2015, as a member of the TIF Commission, you opposed this headquarters for architecture firm BNIM that had been proposed by Shirley Helzberg at a property she owns in the Crossroads. Why did you oppose it?
You know, I've knocked on thousands of doors and had conversations with thousands of voters across Kansas City, and what they are telling me is their voice is not heard at City Hall, and they see a city that can't provide the services and the value that they want for their tax dollars. All of the political positions, stances, movements I've been a part of have been about what the people of Kansas City want. Mm-hmm. So when I was appointed to serve on the TIF Commission, the point of view I brought to those meetings was the point of view of a citizen. What the citizens want is for us to use our TIF program to bring capital to help communities that have real blight. And we did some things on the
commission. Distressed communities, which is what TIF's supposed to be all about, Phil.
Exactly. So the problem I had with the project that you're referencing was this. My business is two blocks away from that project was. We had done a multi-million dollar renovation on our building with no incentives. At the time that was being debated, a $12 million hotel was being built two blocks away. With no incentives. All this was happening in the shadow of the Kauffman Performing Arts Center, and I was being asked to say to my fellow Kansas Cityans that I believed that particular property was blighted. I'm not going to say something I don't believe is true. Mm-hmm. And while that point of view may have been outside the mainstream of that small group of political insiders, and it might have been out of step with what the mayor's office wanted, I can tell you it was absolutely in step with what Kansas Cityans believe about the TIF program.
So how surprised were you then, Phil, when the mayor called you and said, you're no longer on my TIF commission?
I wasn't surprised. I knew that there was going to be some trouble. But, you know, getting into any kind of position in Kansas City, whether it's elected or appointed, shouldn't be about just getting into that position and hanging on to it. You know, we've got major changes, major challenges coming our way in our community. And I think the only way we get through them and come out stronger on the other side is if everybody starts standing up for what they believe and saying what they think.
Did that get you thinking about running for mayor, that move, removing you from the TIF commission?
It did. It made me realize that I had reached the limit of what I could accomplish for our community as an activist. I had spent years helping other candidates run for office, supporting causes I believed in, trying to organize my neighbors and rally my community around the things that we need in Kansas City. Better streets and sidewalks, better education for our kids, a safer community. And I believed that by being a grassroots organizer and activist that I could accomplish those goals. And that attitude of an organizer and a volunteer activist is what I brought to the TIF Commission. But that experience did wake me up to the fact that in order for me to have a real impact on my community, I was going to have to go to the next level and become a candidate.
So if you win the mayorship here, then we have Sly James to thank for it. Wouldn't that be ironic?
That's one way of looking at it,
I guess. That's one way to look at it. Okay. You've never served an elected office before. Why do you want to be mayor, have that be your first elected office?
We can't be a successful city unless we have successful neighborhoods. That means high-quality housing that our working families and seniors can afford, quality jobs that our citizens have the skills and the reliable transportation to thrive in, and excellent basic services. These are the things I've done in my career. I believe that my skills fit our needs. This is the right time for a small business leader to step forward and be the leader of Kansas City.
Why not serve on the city council to get the on-the-ground experience that some might say you need?
I think that among other politicians, there are lots of discussions, lots of questions about maneuvering and positioning and laying out a political path to what they want to accomplish. And I just take a different point of view. My point of view about running for office, if that's the way you believe you can best impact your community, is this. You identify the problems that you want to solve. You imagine the impact that you want to see on your own community. And then you run for whatever office you would need to have in order to have that impact. And I believe we don't just need a change in leadership at City Hall. We need a change in our political culture. Hmm. Too much of the focus has been on luxury development downtown and not on our neighborhoods. Too much of the focus has been on the outside and not enough on the foundation. And you can't change the direction of politics in Kansas City as one member of the city council. You can do a lot of good. You can serve your constituents very well. You can be a great leader for your community. But in order to spark the culture change that I believe needs to take place, I truly believed that I needed to have the resources and the platform of the mayor's office to do it.
Phil Glenn, a candidate for mayor, is my guest. What's the one main thing you'd want to get done as mayor, Phil? What would you focus on?
We have to deliver value for our taxpayers in their neighborhoods. That means we need to pick the trash up on time. We need to fix these potholes. We need to clear the snow and ice when it falls.
So you're a basic services kind of guy.
But I would go beyond that, because I think when we talk about it only in terms of basic services, it's too limiting. And there's a false debate in our community about, are you going to be the person who is for development, or are you going to be the person who is for neighborhoods? The two are connected. Neighborhood stability is the foundation of economic stability. You cannot have economic growth without strong neighborhoods. You cannot have safety without strong neighborhoods. Mm-hmm. And I don't believe that building strong neighborhoods is just about providing what we think of as basic city services. It means building affordable housing. I've built thousands of units of affordable housing in my career. It means jobs. I've created thousands of jobs by investing in the kinds of things Kansas City needs: grocery stores, infrastructure, small business. I've been doing that in the private sector, and I believe that I step into this role of city leadership that I can do this for Kansas City.
You know, help me understand here. Why do you think you're the best candidate for this job? I mean, you're running against 10 other people. Why Phil Glenn?
Because I have the experience of taking action on these issues. With so many problems in Kansas City, we've had commissions, we've had reports, we've had studies, we've had debate. What's been missing is concrete action. And the skill set that I bring as a business owner is that I have to take action on these issues. I have to catalyze change if I want to see it happen. That's the standard that I'm held to in my business. And I believe that's the standard that our elected leaders should be held to. And I believe that I'm the candidate who is best, most ready to step up and take that challenge.
But Kansas City does not have a strong mayor form of government. You're one of 13 votes on the city council. How does that mindset fit when you're just another member of a council, in a sense, maybe with a bigger bully pulpit?
I believe that the structure of government we have in Kansas City actually fits my leadership style really well. The mayor is not just another council member, or we probably wouldn't be sitting here having this conversation. Kansas Cityans put a lot of focus on who their mayor is. Kansas Cityans feel real ownership of that office, and Kansas Cityans believe that the mayor should be the microphone for their voice. They should be able to communicate directly with the mayor to say the kind of city that they want to see. And then the mayor can spread that vision among the city council members and help each individual council member identify and connect what's going on in their district with the goals of the overall city. The problem has been, and this is the conversation I have with thousands of Kansas Cityans north and south of the river, east and west of Troost, is that their voice has not been heard at City Hall.
Mm-hmm. You know, the same week you announced for Mayor, Phil, another event shook your life. Your wife was robbed at your home by a teenager who had come by asking for help. Tell us about that.
I was out of town on business. A young person knocked on our door, said he needed help getting home. My wife opened up the doors of our home to this young person, showed him respect, showed him love, tried to help him, and to make a long story short, this interaction ended up with him pulling out a gun, taking her cell phone, taking her keys, and stealing our car. And I thank God every day that car is the only thing we lost, because in 2018, we lost 136 Kansas Cityans to homicide. That's a shocking number. So what that experience showed me was this. We are not doing enough for our young people in Kansas City. We need to be a community that wraps our arms around every member of this younger generation, and we need to build them up. Every child in Kansas City needs to have the same opportunities that my wife and I are trying to give to our three children.
And how do you do that, Phil?
You do it by... Here's been my experience of raising kids. They don't listen to what you say. They watch what they watch what you do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I see the things that my kids do that make me proud, when I see the things that my kids do that sometimes bug me a little bit, I realize that most of the time they're just imitating what they've seen the adults around them do.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when it's annoying, it's the things that they've seen me do. And when it, you know, makes me happy and proud, it's the things they've learned from Elizabeth, my wife, their mom.
So how do you bring that kind of mindset into the households of thousands of Kansas City kids who don't have that?
By showing action. That's the point I'm trying to make. Kids can tell when you're serious because they know that words don't count. Action is what counts. And so we can't continue to have debate over just an affordable housing policy. We need to have implementation of investment in affordable housing in Kansas City. That's what I've been doing in my career. That's what I want to do for Kansas City. We can't have debates about when are we going to get around to fixing the potholes in Kansas City. We need implementation of a real plan to rebuild our infrastructure in Kansas City. And so when it comes to building up every young person in our entire community, we have to show them that we love them. We have to show them that we care for them by treating neighborhoods east of Troost as well as we treat neighborhoods west of Troost, north and south of the river.
You know, there seems to be a new focus in this community. We've talked about it on the show any number of times. We've gone from a very intense focus on all things downtown to more of a focus on the east side of Kansas City. How do you continue that? I mean, you've mentioned affordable housing, but we're talking about real dollars here, the need for big money to begin the transformative change I hear you talking about here.
We have to think differently than we have been about economic development for the last 20 years. The focus for the last 20 years for city leadership has been building buildings. Economic development isn't just about buildings, it's about people. Here's a number to think about. Region-wide, our unemployment picture looks pretty good on paper, 3.5%. The problem is you start diving neighborhood by neighborhood and you see there are communities in Kansas City where that number is 20, 30, or 50%. Yet at the same time, we have businesses, major corporations like Cerner, all the way to mid-sized construction companies to barbershops that say, we have jobs open today that we can't fill.
Mm-hmm.
We can't find and keep good people to help our business be successful. That makes me sad because that means that there are people who are missing out on economic opportunities. But it also is exciting to me because it shows me that we have a real opportunity to grow our economy on the east side of Kansas City, really all over Kansas City. But since we're talking specifically about the east side, this isn't about bringing in hundreds of millions of dollars to do major real estate projects. This is about giving our citizens the skills that they need to be successful. And then once we've given them the skills, let me talk to you about another number, solving this issue. Public transportation in Kansas City only reaches 18% of the jobs. So after we invest in people's workforce development, their skill development, we need to build a system of public transportation that gets our workers safely and efficiently to the job on time.
You're saying the transit system right now doesn't get that done.
The transit system that we have right now is not designed around where our employment centers are.
Mm-hmm.
And now we can't change these things overnight because there are lots of people who have built their lives around our public transit system,
mm-hmm.
specifically Kansas Cityans who are living with disabilities. But we do need to recognize that when we have a public transit system that doesn't get people to work, we have a public transit system that doesn't work.
I want to go back to what you were saying just a minute ago about the need for workforce development. The new governor of Missouri, Mike Parson, is talking about that. The state of Kansas is talking about that. What do you have in mind? Because, again, that kind of program can go in any number of directions. It can be extremely costly. What do you envision?
Bring all the stakeholders to the table. Business, community colleges, technical trade schools, unions, but also the people who mentor our young Kansas Cityans about what the next move might be for them after high school. Maybe that's coaches. Maybe that's faith leaders. Maybe that's parents. We need a chief skills officer in the mayor's office to coordinate all of these efforts. We have job training programs in Kansas City. The problem is our career education landscape is just as fragmented as our K-12 education landscape is. If we bring everybody together, we'll find efficiencies that will save money. I'll make sure we're spending the workforce dollars we have as efficiently as we possibly can, and then I will go fight for outside dollars from Missouri, from the federal government, from the private and philanthropic sector. We need to give our businesses an opportunity to invest in this workforce development system, because they're the ones who needed to change more than anybody else. And then we need to focus on the industries where these job opportunities are today, which is technology and construction, but be nimble. Because mm-hmm. the economy changes all the time. I mean, that's what I see from my experience in business. We see constant change out there. Mm-hmm. So this won't be something where Phil Glenn gets elected, we create a program, set it in stone, and it never changes. It's going to have to change constantly as the opportunities change.
Mm-hmm. Let's go back to violent crime, and I want to just zero in on that and how you would approach it. Are we talking more officers, a heavier focus on mental health, Phil, more wraparound services? I hear maybe it's all of those things. What's your plan?
Short term, long term. Short term, we do need more officers on the streets. Short term, the next mayor has to fight to preserve and expand the funding we have for social workers in our patrol stations. And then we need to take a step back and recognize that this unacceptable level of violence in our community and the failure of our economy are fundamentally linked. Mm-hmm. A lack of affordable housing in Kansas City is destabilizing families. A lack of quality jobs is making the problem worse. A city that can't pick the trash up on time, that can't provide basic city services, is saying to neighborhood leaders, we do not value you. That is an environment in which crime will thrive. We will not become a safer community until we become a more economically just community. And we won't get there until we change how we think about economic development. Again, this isn't about investing in buildings. This is about building up our people with workforce development and reliable transportation to help them be successful in their own lives.
So you're talking about a multifaceted strategy here. And if I'm sensing the urgency in your voice, steer me if I'm wrong, but you're talking about adding more police officers pretty quickly, a workforce development component being implemented pretty quickly, affordable housing going down that road pretty quickly. How do you get all that done?
Think about downtown. For 20 years, it's all any political leader talked about.
Right.
It's what the private sector talked about. It's what the public sector talked about. It was a cultural movement of our entire region because everybody recognized that having a dead downtown was holding all of us back. That is how we have to think about this. This is going to take more than one mayoral administration. It's going to take more than one level of government. And it's going to take massive investment of money, but also time and energy and heart by Kansas Cityans mm-hmm. to make it a point of pride to say, I'm going to get out of my bubble. I'm going to get out of my comfort zone. I'm going to get out of the little narrow lane in which I live my life, and I'm going to reach out to Kansas Cityans who are different from me. I'm going to build relationships across all of these barriers that we have created. Because again, this won't just make us a safer community. What I'm talking about will make us more strong economically. There is a connection between our economic situation and our safety. You can't have one without the other.
You know, some folks listening to this might wonder, they might be thinking that right now in Kansas City, the city's already spending something like 76, 77% of its general fund on public safety, which includes firefighting. But under the broad umbrella of public safety, we're already, three of every $4 is already going there. You want to increase that. What has to go by the wayside to get that done?
That right there tells you all you need to know about what's driving the violence in our community. This isn't just about spending public dollars on public safety. This has to be about changing the patterns of private investment so that we can have more grocery stores, more child care centers, better infrastructure in all of our communities across Kansas City. And getting back to the beginning of our conversation, this is what I was trying to say as a member of the TIF Commission, mm-hmm. that the public is crying out for reinvestment in neighborhoods. The public knows exactly what they want. I'm hearing it at the doors as I knock on doors across Kansas City. I've been hearing it for years as I've been an activist and a volunteer for various causes in our community. I tried to bring that voice forward at the TIF Commission, and people didn't want to hear it.
But how do you get grocery stores into food deserts in this community when grocers don't want to build there? Or are you talking about doing something like Kansas City, Kansas has done? The city government, the county government there has actually invested in the private sector to develop grocery stores in certain parts of the community. Is that what needs to happen here?
We need to bring investment from outside Kansas City to address the issues that we have inside
Kansas
City.
But folks don't want to invest on the east side.
Well, I think you're wrong. And I think it takes somebody who in the private sector. Let me take a step back and tell you what I do.
Yeah.
The business that my wife and I own has built over 5,000 homes and created over 5,000 jobs by bringing private investment capital into Native American communities. some of the lowest income, most poverty stricken, most economically struggling communities in the country that lots of people have always said, nothing good will ever happen there. Nobody will ever invest money there. Well, here's how you change that dynamic. You don't try to come in from the outside and tell people what to do. No economic development vision is ever successful if it's handed down from on high by leadership or imposed from the outside. You go into a community, you identify who the leaders are, and you listen. You support them as they build a consensus in their community around a vision, and once the community is on board, then you bring in the investment dollars to make it happen. So the way we do this in Kansas City is we start by listening to neighborhood leaders about what they want to see in their own communities. We support them as they rally their community around that vision. They will bring to the project, they will bring that project or that development to the point where the only thing that's missing is money. That's where I come in. The skill set I bring to the mayor's office is the ability to bring these various sources of capital from all across the country. New markets tax credits, low-income housing tax credits, opportunity zones, federal home loan bank dollars. There will never be enough money in the city budget to address these problems. That is not a good reason to give up. There is access to capital out there. And the difference between the communities that will get that investment and the communities that won't is focus and hustle. That's what I'm ready to bring to this effort, to bring massive private investment from the outside into our communities to do economic development so we can focus our public dollars on what the taxpayers have said they want them to be spent on, which is basic infrastructure, basic city services, and a safe community.
Again, Phil Glenn is my guest. He's a candidate for Kansas City mayor. I want to, again, skip back to crime. One of the big issues that's emerging in the race is this idea of does the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department need to be locally controlled? It's the only police department in the country now run by the state, which this one is. Does that need to change? Would it make a difference?
In an ideal world, we would have full local control of our police department. What we need is a police department that is accountable to the citizens of Kansas City. But here's the deal. In order to change the governance structure of KCPD, you'd have to spend mountains of political capital and years going down to Jeff City and convincing a state legislature that, by the way, does not have a very good track record of listening to us or caring about what our concerns are, and try to get them to change it. I don't want to spend those years of my life and that energy and that limited time that I'll have as mayor to devote to causes on having a debate about corporate governance. I want to spend that time and energy on neighborhood reinvestment because, again, the community leaders who I speak to and my own experience of living in this city is moving political appointees around on a chessboard isn't going to change anything.
Yeah.
It isn't going to make our community safer. What's going to make our community safer is real investment in our neighborhoods.
Another issue that's emerged of late, the city's spending $1 million a year to support the American Jazz Museum in the 18th and Vine District. Should that continue?
What needs to continue is the revitalization of the cultural heart of our city.
Mm-hmm.
18th and Vine is part of the cultural heartbeat of Kansas City. The art form of jazz traces its roots to Kansas City. And, you know, I hang out at 18th and Vine sometime, and I've had a great time. You know, there's fun stuff to do. There are people who want to have a good time, be safe, have neighborhood restaurants, neighborhood bars, neighborhood entertainment venues in their community, and that is happening at 18th and Vine. You know, if you read the paper, if you look at it just from a political perspective, all you see is the issues. You know, if you go hang out there, then you're going to see what I see, which is a lot of people having a good time and a lot of potential for everything to get better. I am not in the business of just throwing good money after bad.
Mm-hmm.
I want to see change if the city is going to continue to make those investments. But nobody out there listening should doubt that I am not fully committed to our central city. And you can't be committed to a strong central city without a strong, thriving 18th and Vine district.
What about Mayor James' plan for a 3/8 cent sales tax, Phil, to improve early childhood education in this community? That issue will be on the ballot the same day your name's on the ballot to become the next mayor of Kansas City in April. How are you going to vote on that issue?
I'll be voting no.
Because?
This plan does not have the support of our educational leaders, our superintendents.
Just that simple.
It's just that simple. You cannot have a plan like this go through without consensus and collaboration, and we don't have that.
What kind of job, last question, what kind of job has Mayor James done as the mayor of this city for the last 8 years?
I'm excited to be from Kansas City. I love Kansas City. I feel good about the direction we're headed. I voted for Sly James twice. You know, I think that with any leader, especially as their term comes to an end, there's a focus on the scorecard and giving them a grade. And that naturally kind of leads you to focus on the things that you've disagreed with. But I just need to reflect on the fact that I was proud to vote for that man twice. He is somebody who I've worked with, somebody who I've always liked and respected. We've got a lot of connections between our two families, and he makes me proud to be from Kansas City.
That's Phil Glenn. He's a mayor, candidate for mayor of Kansas City. Phil, appreciate your time. Appreciate you sharing your views.
Thank you.
Good luck. Okay. Time for a break. When we come back, the contributions of immigrant women to Kansas City. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, city council members from Leawood, Kansas, and Riverside, Missouri told us how their cities are handling the snow, affordable housing, and a whole lot more. You can hear that and other conversations. You'll find them at kcur.org/uptodate. The Kansas City Star's most recent buyout saw a combined 200 years of experience leave the newspaper. Tomorrow, I'd say close to half of that experience will be sitting in the studio to talk about their careers. That's tomorrow on KCUR. Is up to date. Well, there's no question that immigrants have helped build our world, but some say the contributions of women who settled here have long been underappreciated. Now, with Women's History Month upon us, University of Missouri, Kansas City social historian Sandra Enriquez is taking a look at female immigrants of the past and present who have shaped Kansas City. A native of Mexico, Sandra Enriquez is an assistant history professor at UMKC and director of the university's public history emphasis. Welcome. Nice to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
How far back does the immigrant women's story in Kansas City go, Sandra?
I mean, it goes back until, you know, you can argue that depending on how you define, right, like before this place was even part of the union, right, et cetera. So you can go far back. But if we're going to talk about Kansas City as a city, right, I think that it goes back to the late mid to late 1800s. And so it's had a long legacy.
Okay, but we start with that. But who would be the most contemporary woman you'll be talking about?
So the most contemporary woman that I will be, well, there's two because they're active. So I'll be talking about Dr. Sophia Khan, who is Pakistani-born, and she is the head of KC for Refugees.
Huh.
And then I will also be talking about Alejandra Perez-Gomez, who is working with KS Moda also. She was born in Mexico. And so the two of them are still active in their communities today, and it's a more recent history that they kind of contributed to.
And you've picked them. Why?
So I wanted to profile women who bring a complexity into our understanding of immigration and immigrant history. I wanted to make sure that I covered different backgrounds and people coming from different places.
Mm-hmm.
They're also very involved in various areas, you know, like Dr. Khan, she is helping refugees settle in Kansas City. Alex Gomez is not only working in higher ed as an advisor and, you know, helping folks navigate their college experience at MCC, but she is also working with the Kansas-Missouri Dream Alliance, which is helping people who are undocumented and documented, the Deferment for Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals.
There you go. Thank you.
Yeah, so folks who, you know, who want a better life and education, right, in Kansas City. So they've been politically active. They've been very active on the ground. And so that's why I chose the two of them. But also, I chose them because I could speak to them and I could learn about their history from their own words. And that's something that, especially in Women's History Month, that I wanted to push as a historian that obviously, history is very, it comes from a perspective, a male-centric perspective oftentimes, right? And so our stories, our city narratives, even our national narratives come from the perspective of men. And that's not to say that we shouldn't celebrate, you know, men's history,
mm-hmm.
But also recognize the contributions of women. And in that contribution, there's not a lot of, you know, save documentation, right, of women. We don't have a lot of, like, textbook entries about women immigrants.
And that's why you
want
to emphasize them, you're
yes.
saying.
Yes. Yeah. And so I was able to, you know, do research on them by interviewing them. And mm-hmm. that's, you know, through the use of oral history. And so I was able to learn about their stories and kind of their contributions from their own voices.
I was going to say that may have been easier for you for the more contemporary
yes.
women, the women that you've gone back in history and searched for, just based on what you just said, there isn't as much information mm-hmm. about them. How tough of a job was that?
As a historian, I think that for me, it was a great challenge, right? Finding...
You enjoy that.
Yes, I enjoy
You're
that.
You're a glutton for punishment,
yes,
they say.
Yes, but, yeah. you know, I was able to, once I kind of decided on who I was going to explore in the earlier part. So I will be focusing on Tatiana Dokudovska, who's probably the most prominent woman that I will be covering. She is the founder of the Kansas City Ballet.
Mm-hmm.
So she had some documentation, you know, mm-hmm. so I was able to look for things on her through newspapers. And then the other group that I'll be focusing on is mostly a group of immigrant women, but also first-generation immigrant Italian women that were working in the Northeast called the Rosary Club.
Hmm.
And so I started off looking at the Missouri Valley Special Collections, thinking this is where I'll start. And I was reading through a book that covers just like Kansas City history and ethnic history and racial history. And so I was looking particularly to see like, okay, this is how we're going to get started.
Right.
And there was this line for the the Rosary Club that said, and these women were looking out for their community, period. And I wanted to know more. So of course, in that, I found out that, you know, historian work is being a detective, right? So I needed to know more. Where could I go? So I started looking in newspapers, and there's a folder about them at the State Historical Society huh. here in Kansas City. So I was able to piece together.
So who was the Rosary Club?
Yeah. So the Rosary Club was actually started by a civic organization called the Amber Club. And so they were a group of middle-class white women who wanted to be involved in the community and work with immigrant populations, kind of similar to the working in the Hull House in Chicago, right?
Sure.
And so the group, the organization, worked with different immigrant communities, most notably the Italian community in the Northeast and the Mexican community in the West Side. So the Amber Club is kind of they were kind of the founders of what it is today, like the Guadalupe Center, for example.
Mm-hmm.
And then they also formed this Holy Rosary Club. And so the Rosary Club essentially was, once they got women, like I said, first generation and immigrant Italian women to work, they were able to take the group over. And so the Italian women themselves, rather than, you know, a middle class white organization kind of helping them out, I mean, they were still somewhat involved, but they were able to retract themselves and let the women's group kind of take care of their own community. So
right.
they did it, and they did a lot of work to help out children. They had schools over the summer, and they did a lot of fundraising for the community.
Yeah.
And you know, sometimes we see these contributions as being, you know, it's an everyday life type of thing, right? They're not and city council, you know, advocating every
day. They're underappreciated
yes,
here.
Yes.
But still significant, which is the point of what you're doing
they
here.
They are, yes, mm-hmm. of course. And so they're definitely underappreciated, but, you know, that everyday activism, right? That, or maybe they didn't see themselves as activists, but that everyday involvement and
yeah.
contribution made, you know, the Northeast a better place. And, you know, from my readings, and from the research that I was doing in this group, a lot of people say that was the basis, right? Like this Rosary Club was the basis for the founding of the Don Bosco Center today.
Huh, that's interesting.
So, you know, it's we see this institution, right? Like we see the Guadalupe Center today as well. And we see the center, but we don't think about how
the
it was
origins.
Women, right?
Yeah.
Like the origin story. So without the women, right? Without the community really rallying behind it, it wouldn't be here, right?
We're talking with Sandra Enriquez from UMKC about female immigrants and the contributions they've made to our community here. And we keep talking about what she's going to be talking about without telling you where she's going to be doing the talking. It's going to be Sunday at 2 o'clock at the Central Library, downtown 14 West 10th Street. The title of her talk, Yes, We Can, Immigrant Women and Their Influences on Kansas City. You know, from which countries did these immigrant women come from? And did they come in waves, you know, similar to the groups entering the country nationally these days?
Yeah. So going back, right, I've been talking about the Rosary Club. So they're coming from Italy at the turn of the 20th century, wow, mirroring, you know, our national story. And then you have more contemporary, right? You have a Mexican immigrant, which, you know, Mexican immigration has been constant, although it's been on the downslope now. But it's been a constant throughout the 20th century.
Mm-hmm.
And then when it comes to Dr. Khan coming from Pakistan as a refugee herself, you know, that that kind of mirrors what was happening in the early 90s, et cetera.
Yeah.
So I think that by focusing on, and the reason also why I focus on these particular women was because it's not just about Kansas City, right? There are immigrant experiences add complexities to our understanding of the immigrant story of our nation.
Mm-hmm. You know, did these women come as, were they married at the time? Were they mothers at the time? Were they coming earlier in their lives? Or what did you notice?
Yeah, all of the above, yes.
Okay.
So some were coming as married women with their husbands, like in the case of Dr. Khan. She came with her husband, and others just came at a younger age. So Alex Bettis, for example, she came as a child with her family.
Mm-hmm.
And so they, you know, it varies. And again, it adds to the complexity.
Why did they wind up in Kansas City? They could have gone anywhere. Why here?
Cities are magnets of opportunity, right? And the women that I study in for this talk in particular, they came here in search of opportunity. And so whether it's, you know, lucking out, like for example, in the case of Dr. Khan, her husband's medical residency was in Kansas City, right? So
mm-hmm.
opportunity, right? In the case of Italian women, right, there was an established community here. So it's opportunity for to be able to find a job, right? In the case of Tatiana Dokudovska, it was the fact that she got a gig at Starlight Theater, and she just stayed for, you know, the rest of her life in the city. So it was opportunity that brought them here. And perhaps, you know,
And luck, it sounds like a little bit.
And so perhaps, you know, most of when we think about immigration, especially the earlier part of immigration, we think about immigrants settling in bigger cities, right, like New York or Chicago,
mm-hmm.
or even St. Louis to a point. But Kansas City has always been a magnet of opportunity.
Yeah. So on Sunday, when you talk about these women, you're going to tell their Sophia Khan story, and who else story are you going to tell?
Yeah. The women that I've been mentioning,
mm-hmm.
so Alex Bettis, and I wanted to kind of just profile women. You know, there's so many stories that I could have mentioned. But one, I have limited time, so I could, you know, I always joke that some of the lectures could be a whole semester's class as a professor, right?
Are you going to do a book?
I hope in the future, yes. So I'm currently working on another book that is unrelated to Kansas City. But I've been fascinated, especially by the stories of the earlier immigrant Italian women,
yeah.
which I'm a scholar of Mexican-American Latino history, but I'm just so fascinated by that story.
Well, they are amazing stories. I want to thank Sandra Enriquez for coming in. She's an assistant history prof over at UMKC, director of the university's public history emphasis. She'll be speaking at 2 o'clock on Sunday afternoon at the Central Library downtown. Yes, We Can, Immigrant Women and Their Influence on Kansas City. That's the title of her talk. Thanks for sharing your time and your expertise. I sure appreciate
it. Thank you for having me again.
Coming up, Brian McTavish and some cool stuff to do on your weekend.
She packed my bags last night, pre-flight, 0 hour, 9 a.m. And I'm gonna be high as a kite by then. miss the earth so much. I miss my wife. It's lonely out in space, but I'm such a timeless, a timeless fly.
Well, who do we have here? Brian McTavish is here. That's one thing we have here.
Yeah.
And we're listening to the Little Smokies. Little Smokies.
Yeah.
Welcome back. Good to have you here.
It's Lil.
Lil. Lil
it's,
Smokies.
It's Lil Smokies.
Lil Smokies.
Which could be a comic book, but
yes,
it's
it could.
Not.
Yeah.
You know, maybe some firefighting little superheroes.
Yes.
But anyway, in reality, or what passes for it, Lil Smokies.
Lil Smokies.
They're a rock and bluegrass band sextet from Missoula, Montana. You can catch them at 8 o'clock Friday night at Knucklehead Saloon.
At Knuckles.
But here's the thing. You know, they love their trad bluegrass, their old-timey sounds. But as you can hear for yourself, they're doing Elton John's Rocket Man.
Not bad. Not bad.
Yeah. You can still get a down-home thrill from this sort of thing. I mean, they also do, and this is rather new, they just put out a Beatles cover of, they do Paperback Writer.
Oh, really? Wow.
Right.
Wow.
So, the Mighty Pines open. Now, let me just say, it's a little odd for the Mighty Pines to be on the same bill as the Lil Smokies.
Yes.
That fills me with a little trepidation. But One Night at Knuckleheads can't hurt.
Yes.
So whether you like the 60s or the 70s or the eternal pull of bluegrass music, you're going to have a good time.
Go out and see Frank and say hello at Knuckleheads.
Do it, man. Friday, 8 o'clock at Knuckles, as you say.
Welcome to a night of total terror. The dead live on living flesh. The dead whose haunted souls hunt the living. The living whose bodies are the only food for these ungodly creatures. Night of the Living Dead.
My goodness. Like things, I was feeling okay about things.
And then
I'm back and I'm scared of the world again.
You're a little nervous about what might happen.
What is this?
There might be some gratuitous bloodletting in your future if you should decide to attend Night of the Living Dead. It's the musical stage comedy version of the classic 1968 zombie movie.
Yes.
Which I'm sure you've seen several times.
I think I have.
Have you ever
probably
seen it?
I don't know. I can't remember these things.
The thing is, it's so emblematic and yet so primitive. Kind of like a stumbling zombie.
Very well analyzed
very well.
There.
Very impressive. Quit while you're ahead. You were throwing me a compliment there. Anyway, so check this out. It's 8 o'clock tonight, Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday night at the Empress Theater. Actually, it's been renamed. It used to be Prohibition Hall. Now they want to call themselves the Empress Theater.
This is a stage musical version of a classic movie.
Yes. Now, there's Haunted House season is so far away. October seems, 6 or 7 months away, right?
But
if you're a Fright fan of any stature, or you'd like to be, if you want a good scare-induced laugh, you can be simultaneously shocked and more than lightly amused by the tongue-through-cheek satire evoked by this show. I mean, campy songs and lots of crazy blood. If you sit in the first three rows, you got to pay extra to have body limbs and fake blood, at least I think it's fake, tossed on you. And it's brought to you by the same people who brought us in, people who were involved with Evil Dead the Musical, as well as members of the Second City Comedy Troupe down Chicago way.
Wow.
They've had a hand in this. This is the only official version, stage version of Night of the Living Dead.
My
Except no imitations, even though, as I said, the entrails are probably not real.
Be sure to see Brian's 6 Unexpected Things to Do in Kansas City this week, and you'll find it at kcur.org. What do we have here?
We got a brand new Cadillac.
Yes, we do.
Okay, it's the Kansas City
Auto Show.
And by the way, at the risk of saying the wrong thing, should I take the risk?
Yes.
Your baby doesn't come with the new Caddy.
Mm.
Although it can't hurt, right? How's that going to hurt?
I don't know.
If you drive up in a brand new Cadillac, no one's going to run away.
Yeah.
Right? Okay. So 10 o'clock. It's on right now, right as we speak. You can, as soon as you're done listening to this, you can race down to Bartle Hall all day and all night, through the weekend, through Sunday, for the Kansas City Auto Show. Now, it's got power, it's got speed, and it's got durability. Would you say these cars on the floor, right?
Okay.
And you can even take a test drive. But you know who else has power, speed, and durability?
You can test drive
them? You can.
Where?
Well, you got at the show, you got to let a salesman or two get their hooks in you.
Yeah.
And you got to write things down and give them your information. But you can take a test drive. But also displaying great raw, savage speed and power is Kansas City Chiefs defensive end Chris Jones. That's right. The Chiefs' Chris Jones, the main threat to sack opposing quarterbacks for the Chiefs, will do the autograph thing from 1 to 3 Saturday at the auto show. But let me say this. You can't bring stuff to autograph. First 200 people in line, they get a big picture of him, and that's what you're stuck
that's
with, although I'm sure it's very impressive.
Okay. Okay, talk to me. What's this?
Well, that's what I'm here to do.
That's what you
do. Okay, we got a couple of things that fall under this. First, let's go with the Glow Silent Disco. It'll be a disco inferno. But where's the music at the Glow Silent Disco Inferno, which takes place at 8 o'clock Saturday at the Crossroads Hotel? Where else put in the Crossroads? Well, it's a silent disco because if you think it's in the air, it's not. You have to, like, pay to get in. They give you the little headset, what's called silent disco headset. And that means you got three or four DJs playing a variety of playlists, and I think you can, like, switch channels or figure out which one you want to listen to. So if you just walk in expecting to be moved, you will not be. You must put the headphones on. It's a strange concept. Now, also, Saturday night from 9 to 11 at the Rock Hill Grill, it's the Queer Bar Takeover KC. Here's the quick scoop. On the second Saturday of every month, there's a Facebook group called Queer Bar Takeover KC. They encourage members of the LGBTQ community to visit a different customarily straight bar or club. And this month's Free to Be You and Me destination is the Rock Hill Grill. Think of this. Engage with people who are different from you in a public space. I know it's a wild concept, but let's do it. Let's do it.
And finally today,
talking about you and me and the games people play.
Oh, the games people play now, every night and every day.
Is that Gomer?
It's Gomer.
That's Gomer singing that song.
Also,
I knew I recognized
it. Also known as Jim Nabors, God rest his soul.
Yes.
Gomer could sing. As
loved him
know.
In that show.
Loved him in that show.
You got 30 seconds.
Here we
go.
29, 28, 27. Two types of games to play. There's the Game of Crawls. It's a Game of Thrones. You've heard of Game of Thrones.
Yes, I have.
It's a Game of Thrones costumed bar crawl in downtown's Power and Light District from 3 to 9 Saturday. So just show up between 3 and 4 at KC Live Block. Pay a few bucks and be part of that. Also, KC Improv Family Game Night. Clean, spontaneous, all-ages improvisational comedy for the whole family. 6:30 Saturday night at Kick Comedy Theater in Westport.
Nice job. That's Brian McTavish and your Weekend To-Do List. Thank you, sir.
Oh, it's our weekend.
You were on fire.
Oh,
God, I love it when you're
I'm
on
smoking.
Fire. Find and follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up To Date. Follow me at Steve Kraske. And don't forget to like KCUR on Facebook. On Friday, a music legend and a founding member of the Nitty Gritty Dirt Band, John McEwen, joins us. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Devin Davis, and Elizabeth Ruiz. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.